During a global pandemic, how can we find comfort in the hymn, From God Can Nothing Move Me? You'll find the answer in Pastor Will Wheaton's column on Lutheran Dirges and Such in the latest Issues Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, rapper Flame details his journey from Bapticostal and Reformed Baptist Calvinism to confessional Lutheranism. The free online Issues Etc. journal. It is also difficult to sort out, and it has been the top topic in many cases of the news for months and months and months, now 7 months running. How do we measure success or failure when it comes to pandemic response? If you listen to some people, it's all failure. And if you listen to others, it's all success. And reality, obviously, is somewhere in the middle. Can we say that, say, government lockdowns have proven successful in stopping the spread of this disease? How well have we done as a race, that is globally, and as a country in the United States? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to get an update on the global pandemic with Lyman Stone, adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Then we'll turn to the subject of gender disparity in the church. Is it a recent occurrence that when you walk into church, most of the people there, 60, maybe 70% of the people there, are women? Lyman Stone is a regular guest. He's senior fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies and writes about demographics, family, and American culture. He's author of a recent column for Christianity Today titled Making Your Church Manlier Won't Make It Bigger. Lyman, welcome back to Issues Etc.
It's good to be with you.
Many people are simply wondering, when will the pandemic and all of its restrictions come to an end?
That is difficult to predict, but at this point, we will definitely be seeing continuing spread at least through the end of 2020 and likely into the beginning of 2021. Of course, by summer 2021, we should have several different vaccine options around the world. So hopefully by then, this thing, the actual epidemic spread, can be nipped in the bud, although, of course, we'll still be dealing with the economic ramifications.
How would you describe the course of the pandemic at present?
Well, we had that first wave in, March and April, and then it sort of faded down, and then we had the second wave in the summer, and of course people debate how many waves are there really. I don't really care how you count it. The point is, around the country in total, deaths were very high in March and April, then they fell, then they rose again in the summer, then it looks like they were falling, and there were a few weeks there where I was really hopeful that we were going to have this thing beaten by Christmas at least, but in the last 2 or 3 weeks, we've seen another big increase in the spread of COVID-19. The data I use is not official cases or official deaths. I look at just deaths of all causes. It's a more reliable indicator. It doesn't deal with the problem of, like, how do you classify a COVID death? And then we can walk from there to see the implied spread of the disease under that. And what we can see is that, as school started, infections spiked again by a very large amount, and we're now seeing the deaths arising from those infections.
So let's talk about measuring success or failure in a pandemic response. Why are overall deaths an important indicator to you, the one that you think is most reliable?
Well, when somebody dies, we write a death certificate for them. And so then what do you put on that death certificate? Well, if they get shot, you might say they were killed by a gunshot wound. But then you have to say, well, okay, not all gunshot wounds are the same. If they shot themselves, it's suicide. If someone else shot them, it's homicide. Or it's assault, perhaps. And sometimes you don't know who shot them, so it's undetermined, right? But that's a simple case, right? So with a disease, like, let's say someone has cancer, and then you give them a drug that you think is gonna cure their cancer, but it suppresses their immune system, and then they get pneumonia, and they die of pneumonia. Well, what killed them? Was it the cancer or the pneumonia? Well, pneumonia killed them, but the only reason they got pneumonia is because they had cancer, and we gave them a drug to suppress their immune system so we could deal with cancer. COVID is a uniquely thorny case of this because we're still figuring out how to diagnose it well. We're still figuring out rules for exactly when you should count it. We're still learning the symptoms and who should we be testing. In the first months of the pandemic, if you look at official cause of death data, there was a huge spike in deaths of heart disease, flu, miscellaneous respiratory reasons, lung disease, dementia. Every death of natural causes rose in February and March. Why? Was it because there was a massive spike in heart attacks and flu? No. It's because COVID causes heart failure in many people, and the symptoms are similar to flu. And at that time, we didn't really understand how widely it was spreading. So the problem with classifying cause of death, it gets very complicated. And then it's like, oh, who do you count? Who do you not count? And it gets almost political. So to avoid that, we can just count how many dead bodies there are in total. And we can compare that to how many dead bodies there usually are. So we can see, you know, we get some debates about how do you count the baseline? Do you do the previous year, the previous 5 years, the average, whatever? But basically, you come up with a baseline. It doesn't really matter that much which one you choose. And you compare how many dead bodies in a given week or in a given area do we have versus what the baseline says we normally would have had. And the difference we call excess deaths. And if those excess deaths are very correlated with COVID-19 cases, so diagnosed cases, in terms of like the excess deaths are happening in the same places and at the same time as the cases, if they're happening among similar age groups of people, and if we also see that they're like, these aren't suicides or like car accidents, right? These are some kind of disease death, right? I mean, we can check that. I can talk about that some. Then we can pretty safely conclude that if deaths are up 20% and it's happening entirely in places that have a lot of COVID cases and in times that have a lot of COVID cases, and it's entirely of like disease-related and mostly respiratory-related conditions, then we can pretty safely conclude that these are actually COVID deaths, regardless of how you classify them. These are COVID deaths. So by that count, we've had about 300,000 COVID deaths in the United States.
Have government-enforced lockdowns in all their various forms proven successful in curbing the infection rate or in affecting that measure that you just described, excess deaths?
Not very much. It depends, of course, on how you define lockdown. Some people are like, well, if you cancel school, it's a lockdown. Other people are like, well, unless there's tanks in the street and like guns pointed at people in apartments, it's not really a lockdown. So people mean all kinds of things by lockdown. What we can say, though, is that specific policies like stay-at-home orders by governments, like when the government specifically issues a legal order saying you must stay at home except for essential purposes, and if you're found outside for non-essential purposes, you'll be punished. These orders are not associated with any better outcome. Places that had these orders had no difference in their outcomes than places that had different policies, with pretty much regardless, doesn't matter what controls you use, it just didn't matter. Some things do matter more, so like restaurant closures seem like they maybe helped a little bit. Increasingly, there's growing evidence that school closures probably did help quite a bit. Actually, deaths of school-aged children are down by a lot in every country that canceled school. So like in Sweden, where they didn't cancel school, deaths of school-aged children are up slightly, whereas in other countries, deaths of school-aged children are way down. Of course, that's, you know, not a lot of school-aged children die, so we're not talking huge numbers here. And of course, generally, governments like declaring emergencies and telling people to be cautious and using these like nice color codes and stuff to communicate risk, this stuff is helpful in a way because it informs people. But these really, really strict, like, you know, if you step outside your house, you're going to be punished, or, you know, if you hug someone at the park, it's a crime. Like, these policies don't do anything.
We're talking with demographer Lyman Stone about the global pandemic. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're connected to Issues, Etc. It's week three of our silent auction. Proceeds benefit the new studios of Issues, Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and the Word of the Lord Endures Forever. Our auction items this week are the mic stand and headphones from the old Issues Etc. studio. You can place your bid by sending an email to lynn@issuesetc.org, lynn@issuesetc.org, or by giving us a call, 618-223-8385. We'll announce the highest bid on Wednesday, October the 7th, and the winner on Friday, October the 9th. When we come back, what is the demographic of the typical person that COVID kills? We'll be right back.
Talk Radio for the Thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The grace of God, the church's music, the Lord's Supper every service every Sunday, preaching Christ crucified and risen, our hope for years to come. There is hope in St. Louis, Hope Lutheran Church, that is. 5218 Neosho Street, St. Louis, Missouri. Find us on the web at hopelutheranstl.org.
During a global pandemic, how can we find comfort in the hymn, From God Can Nothing Move Me? You'll find the answer in Pastor Will Whedon's column on Lutheran Dirges and Such in the latest Issues, Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, rapper Flame details his journey from Bapticostal and Reformed Baptist Calvinism to confessional Lutheranism. The free online Issues Etc. journal. We are getting an update on the global pandemic with Lyman Stone, adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies and writes about demographics, family, and American culture. Lyman, what is the demographic of the typical person that COVID kills?
The typical person who dies of COVID is going to be over 65. However, death rates are elevated. We see pretty high, relatively high death rates for pretty much anyone over 45. So we typically say that COVID kills about one in every 150 people that it infects. But once you're over 45, that's not really true anymore. As you get over 45, it changes, you know, to one in every 100, one in every 75, one in every 50. By the time you're over 65, you're talking about one in every 30 or so people that get COVID will die. At 75, you're talking about one in every 15-ish. So, of course, there's debate about exactly how to count all these things, and the statistics. But among very young people who get it, of course, the death rate is extremely low, blessedly. But most people who die of COVID are going to be retirees or near retirement age.
What appears to be the best set of strategies to control the spread of the virus?
Well, that depends on the situation. Back in February, I was arguing to anyone who would listen that people should be wearing masks, that we should be avoiding large gatherings, and that we needed travel restrictions, and pretty strict ones. I don't know if I was on Issues, Etc. saying this, but on other podcasts I was saying, you know, if states are worried about the legal challenge to it, they shouldn't make it a law. They should just go and flip over a dump truck on the interstate. And then it's not that they're legally blocking it. It's just that, boy, it takes a long time to move that dump truck. But we're past that point now. Every state has local infections. The most effective strategy is travel restrictions. Would have been to set up essentially a cordon around early outbreak spots and seal them off. That's not an option anymore, which means there aren't actually a lot of good control options. Now, we can do things like we can avoid having large indoor close gatherings of people. So keeping school canceled is an important part of that. I think we should keep school canceled. I mean, I feel like we should keep public school canceled. We should just never reopen public schools. I mean, that's ideal, but that's just because I prefer a different model of schooling generally. But yes, we should keep schools canceled because although children don't get the disease severely, they do spread it. And there are a lot of people who touch each other, talk loudly, and they're in close together in often poorly ventilated buildings for long periods of time. But generally speaking, yeah, I think it's important to continue limiting the size of gatherings. I mean, you know, it's difficult to have a fixed rule. You know, say, well, you know, you in principle, 20 people isn't a problem if it's 20 people outdoors wearing a mask and it's the same 20 people who always hang out with each other. At the same time, three single people who have three different social circles getting together and talking to each other without a mask for 15 minutes indoors is a problem, right? So what really needs to happen is people need to form complete social circles. That is, people that they socialize with those people and no one else. That is, you're in or you're out. So they get called pods or whatever. I've been advocating those for a while, and they're they're effective. You kind of pick your people, and those are the people you're going to see for the next year.
Are there any true success stories in the last 7 months of the pandemic?
Yes, absolutely. Many countries have managed to avoid a severe outbreak. They did it basically by wearing masks very early and tightly restricting travel. So Taiwan, actually much of Asia, has been quite successful in this regard. China, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, much of Southeast Asia, places that really early on they adopted nearly universal masking and they restricted travel. Unfortunately, in developed countries, we resisted masks for a long time. And to this day, we don't severely restrict travel. You know, there's still planes landing. You can still drive across state lines.
How would you evaluate America's response to the pandemic overall?
I mean, the truth is there hasn't been a lot of difference in how developed countries in the West have responded. Now we say, oh gosh, if Trump had listened to the experts, it'd be so different. Well, Europe did listen to the experts. And excess deaths in Europe have risen by about the same amount as in the United States. The reality is the experts early on are wrong. They were saying masks were not important. Travel bans don't work. We just need to have really strict lockdowns. And that'll do the trick. And the reason they thought that is because that's what China did. And everybody wanted to emulate China. Well, that's not all China did. The main thing China did was restrict travel within the country. They cut off travel. And that worked. And it just happened to be at the same time as lockdowns. And so countries emulated the lockdowns, but not really the travel rules. So there have been success stories, but there are things that at this point are quite difficult to emulate.
Are there any massive failure stories that stick out to you when it comes to a response to the pandemic?
There are specific policies that we can now see were extremely misguided and destructive. So, for example, like moving elderly patients with COVID into nursing homes was definitely a terrible choice. You know, specifically lockdowns were clearly not a very good choice. We should have been telling people, go to parks, get outside, don't stay inside all the time. That's what we should have been saying, but it's not what we said. We said, stay home, don't go out, don't step outside. And that was very unwise. We shouldn't have been saying that. So there's definitely specific policies that have been destructive. And certainly there's huge variation by places. I mean, Hawaii's had virtually no outbreak at all, partly because they did impose travel restrictions in Hawaii because they're an island, they could. Puerto Rico, similar situation. And of course, New York and New Jersey have been terrible. So I have like District of Columbia, Massachusetts, Mississippi's been quite bad. Arizona's had a rough time with it. But at the end of the day, most of this is not really about policy. Sort of about the random fluke of who got infected first and just the social networks that happened and ultimately the failure to close borders, but nobody really closed their borders. So it's hard to say there's been one big failure when everyone made the same mistakes.
Is President Trump vulnerable politically on the U.S. response to the pandemic?
Certainly. I mean, regardless of the truth or falsity of anything I've said so far, it's certainly true that there's a perception that the U.S. has had a uniquely bad situation because the U.S. resisted dramatic responses. I think there's places where President Trump made the right call, even at times where it was unpopular to do so, like he put in travel restrictions on China fairly early and then on Europe earlier than people wanted him to, and he got criticism for that. I think that was ultimately wise for him to do that. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough. It was not nearly enough, but it was something. Might have bought us a few days, possibly. And then there's other places where he's very clearly part of the problem. He was quite clearly opposed to masks early on. Now he seems to have come around a bit, though he still seems to be pretty skeptical of them. And certainly the fact that he got COVID and then failed to disclose his positive test and infected others for several days definitely creates an image of carelessness as Americans around the country have been trying to be scrupulous and careful and protect others and their families and not infect others. The reality is in most communities in America now, there's a social norm that if you even think you have COVID and you go and hang out with someone, you've pretty much said goodbye to that friendship, that you should be isolating yourself. That's the dominant social norm now. And if that's not the dominant social norm in your social circles, It might be because you're in a very unusual social circle, because most Americans are at a point where a suspected diagnosis is enough that that continuing to visit your friends would be seen as a considerable moral violation of basic friendship. So I think the problem is that Trump didn't behave the way most Americans now see as minimum standards of decency. Now, one could argue that that's been true about Trump since the first day of his campaign 4 years ago. But in this case, it's a situation where a lot of other Americans have, at great personal cost, made big sacrifices to try and create these norms. So, yeah, I think he's politically vulnerable.
What about Vice President Biden? Where is he most vulnerable on this issue?
The thing about a crisis is it hardly matters if you really contributed to it or not. You're vulnerable. And the thing about being outside of government during a crisis is it doesn't really matter if you have a good plan or not. It's always easier to be on the sidelines. So, I mean, during the debate, there was this moment where President Trump said, oh, Fauci changed his mind on masks. And Biden said, no, he didn't. Well, President Trump was right. Fauci did change his mind on masks. The whole medical establishment changed. They flip-flopped on it and changed. And their advice led to probably many thousands of deaths because they were discouraging masks. You know, Biden was clearly in the wrong there. But does that mean he's vulnerable? Maybe, but are Americans going to just like suddenly lose confidence in their local doctors because of this? No, probably not. They're still going to go to the doctor for things, even though the medical establishment was very clearly completely wrong about COVID for the first few months. I mean, the whole thing about ventilators being the main thing we can do, you know, hospitals never hit their capacity in most places, and ventilators didn't get nearly as much use and weren't nearly as beneficial as was hoped. We're finding other treatments that maybe work a little bit better. All that to say, you know, but the medical establishment isn't going to lose credibility over this. In the same way, yeah, Biden was wrong. He's not going to pay a price for making a false statement about the history of the debate about masks, because most Americans are sympathetic to that history. Most Americans say, yeah, I thought masks were dumb, but now it seems like a good idea. And most people don't like to think back and think about their own, oh, wow, I thought masks were dumb. They don't want to publicly admit that they were part of the problem. So I don't think Biden will pay a penalty for the fact that he's aligned himself with an establishment that fundamentally gave disastrous advice.
What about President Trump's assertion that Biden criticized him for closing the borders in early spring, calling it xenophobic?
Yeah, I mean, I think Biden was obviously wrong there. He was totally incorrect. Closing the borders was wise. In fact, Trump didn't go far enough on closing the borders. At the same time, again, while Biden was wrong, he was, I don't think he's going to pay a political price for that. Lots of people look back on January and February and they see in themselves, wow, I didn't take it seriously enough. And they feel bad about that. And they're not going to punish Biden for not taking it seriously enough either, because people don't like to punish themselves. And so while, yes, I agree, Biden was in the wrong, it was foolish, all this stuff, it should have been predictable, I don't think he's going to pay a political price for that. Now, whether he should pay a political price, I guess, is another question. But I don't think he will.
Speaking of a pandemic, Pastor Will Wheaton has written an essay about a hymn that was penned during a plague in 1563. The hymn is "From God Can Nothing Move Me." His article is called "On Lutheran Dirges and Such." You can read it absolutely free in the latest online Issues Etc. journal. There's a red subscription button on the right-hand side of our website, issuesetc.org. When you click on that, you'll be asked to enter your email address. And when you've done that, you're subscribed to the online Issues Etc. journal. Lyman Stone is our guest. He's author of a recent column for Christianity Today titled "Making Your Church Manlier Won't Make It Bigger." We'll take up that subject after the break. Is gender disparity in Christianity something new? And what is the role of fertility in church growth? We'll be right back. We'll be right back. What's the relationship between the Book of Proverbs and the Ten Commandments? Find out with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Provoking Proverbs, Wisdom, and the Ten Commandments. It's a new 10-lesson Bible study produced by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or read an excerpt of Provoking Proverbs at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Provoking Proverbs, Wisdom, and the Ten Commandments. 1-800-325-3040.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Life Ministry is thousands of people sharing Christ's love and mercy and giving witness to our Lord's creation of life, His design for marriage and the family, and the God-given value of all human life from conception to natural death. Working with many partners, LCMS Life Ministry sponsors human care efforts that meet the needs of body and soul and provides resources and educational events for all ages. To learn more, email lifeministry@lcms.org and visit lcms.org/life.
I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel, writes St. Paul in his opening salvo to the Galatians. There is indeed no other gospel than that which we taught to you. And that's what the October issue of the Lutheran Witness is all about, the gospel proclaimed to you through the letter of St. Paul to the Galatians. Visit witness.lcms.org to learn more. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University Chicago, with a message for parents, grandparents, and godparents of college-bound children. Concordia Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We're devoted to our Lutheran confession and committed to strong academics. Please encourage your child, grandchild, or godchild to check out Concordia University Chicago at cuchicago.edu.
So what is the obedience of Christ? The obedience of Christ is our salvation. It's what gives us eternal life.
Pastor Hans Feeney speaking at the 2020 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And the obedience of Christ is also the lens through which we are able to properly see the commandments of God. So through Christ's obedience, he lets us see the commandments for what they are, as the very things that our Lord used to protect us and preserve us and save us from condemnation and from death.
You can watch and listen to Pastor Hans Feeney teaching Making the Case for the Obedience of Christ and all of the presentations from this year's Making the Case conference. You can watch an on-demand video stream or download a podcast for a tax-deductible contribution of $250. Learn more and order at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385.